nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
Yo, what's up? How y'all doing out there in Techno Land? RCT Techno DJs in the house. Oh yeah, bringing you the only fat beats in Pittsburgh, right here on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM, word to your mother.
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
WRCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1940.
Nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call, jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
WRCT, the inside from way out.
USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
DJ Heim from Forest, and you're listening to 88.3 WRCT.
nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
People marched and demonstrated, and apartheid ended. And democracy and freedom were born.
South African anti-apartheid leader Archbishop Desmond Tutu has died at the age of 90. Today, we'll hear the Nobel Peace Prize winner in his own words on fighting apartheid to opposing the U.S. invasion of Iraq.
We said then, and we keep saying so, not just that it was illegal, it was immoral.
We'll re-air two Democracy Now! Interviews with Archbishop Tutu and hear two speeches, one at the massive anti-war rally in New York in 2003 and another outside the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen in 2009.
And for those who think that the rich are going to escape... sing together. Amen. We have one world.
Today, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, in his own words, on war, apartheid, Palestine, Guantanamo, climate change, and more. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Coronavirus cases are skyrocketing in the United States and in many parts of the world, with the fast-spreading Omicron variant combining with lax public health measures and holiday gatherings to drive daily infections to pandemic-level highs. Here in the U.S., more than 200,000 people are testing positive for coronavirus each day, nearly reaching last winter's peak, with the U.S. on pace to surpass 1 million daily infections in January. U.S. airlines canceled thousands of flights over the Christmas holiday, citing increasing rates of illness among flight crews. Meanwhile, many school districts and colleges have announced a return to online classes. Public health officials warn of a surge in pediatric COVID-19 cases, with Northeastern hospitals seeing a fourfold increase in the number of children hospitalized in the past 2 weeks. In China, some 13 million residents of the city of Xi'an have been ordered to remain at home after officials reported more than 200 coronavirus infections, the most China has reported since March 2020. The strict lockdown comes just weeks before Beijing is set to host the Winter Olympics. At the Vatican, Pope Francis used his Christmas address to advocate for universal health care and access to vaccines.
Dio con noi.
Grant health to the infirm and inspire all men and women of goodwill to seek the best ways possible to overcome the current health crisis and its effects. Open hearts to ensure that necessary medical care, and vaccines in particular, are provided to those people who need them most.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu, the South African anti-apartheid icon who championed human rights struggles around the globe, died on Sunday at the age of 90. In 1984, Desmond Tutu won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work fighting to end white minority rule in South Africa. That same year, he traveled to Washington, D.C., where he denounced the Reagan administration's support of the apartheid government. After the fall of apartheid and the election of Nelson Mandela as South Africa's first black president, Archbishop Tutu chaired the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where he pushed for restorative justice. Tutu was a prominent opponent of the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. He condemned the Israeli occupation of Palestine and spoke out against torture and the death penalty. After headlines, we'll hear Desmond Tutu in his own words on war, apartheid, Palestine, Guantanamo, climate change, and more. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said Sunday he plans to double the number of Israeli settlers living in the occupied Golan Heights. Bennett announced the move after the Biden administration signaled it would not challenge Donald Trump's recognition of the Golan Heights as sovereign Israeli territory. Israel captured the Golan Heights from Syria during the 67 war and annexed the territory in 1981 in defiance of international law. In Burma, human rights groups say at least 35 civilians were massacred by government forces Friday as they fled fighting in a village in eastern Kaya State. Among the dead were women, children, and two staffers with the international aid group Save the Children. Photos from the site showed charred bodies and three burned-out vehicles. The UN's top humanitarian official, Martin Griffiths, condemned the attack and called on Burma's military rulers to protect civilians. Aid groups say a crackdown by government forces has left more than 1,300 people dead since Burma's military overthrew the democratically elected government of Aung San Suu Kyi in February. The bodies of at least 27 refugees, including a baby, were discovered after they washed ashore on the western coast of Libya Saturday. The refugees likely drowned in recent shipwrecks, as Libya has become a key departure point for those trying to reach safety in Europe. Meanwhile, the bodies of 16 people, who are among another group of 27 refugees who died last month trying to cross the English Channel, were returned to their hometown in Iraqi Kurdistan Sunday. This is one of their family members.
In Kurdistan, for more than 7 or 8 years, there has been a lack of work, and young people have no work in the government sector or the private sector. All these young people traveled to achieve their dreams and goals and to reach a country that provides a decent life with dignity. Because, unfortunately, in this country, they do not live with dignity.
In northeastern Brazil, authorities issued flash flood warnings after a pair of dams collapsed Saturday night amid heavy rainfall. Officials say the floods have driven over 35,000 people from their homes. Parts of Bahia State have received rainfall that's six times greater than the December average. Here in the United States, hundreds of temperature records fell over the Christmas holiday weekend as Texas and southeastern states experienced spring like conditions. Dallas-Fort Worth Airport hit 82 degrees Fahrenheit on Saturday, a Christmas record for North Texas, and just 7 degrees cooler than the high on the 4th of July. Texas lawyer Sarah Weddington, who successfully argued the landmark abortion rights case Roe v. Wade, died Sunday at the age of 76. Weddington was just 26 years old when she brought a class action lawsuit challenging Texas's ban on abortions all the way to the Supreme Court. The court's 1973 ruling set a precedent legalizing abortion nationwide that stands to this day. In 2012, Sarah Weddington spoke with KPBS Public Television about her long legal career.
You look back as I was growing up, and there were so many limits on what women could do. Women couldn't even run full court in basketball. We got half court and two dribbles. We didn't get credit unless our fathers or our husbands signed for us. Now most people get a credit card offer every week. We didn't get to make decisions about our own reproductive. We didn't get to go to law school. I was in the first group of women who went to law school. We didn't get equal pay. And so what we've been doing all these years is trying to push back barriers so that women could make more decisions.
Earlier this month, the Supreme Court's conservative justices appeared ready to dramatically roll back Roe v. Wade as they heard oral arguments on a challenge to Mississippi's 15-week abortion ban. In El Salvador, three women serving 30 years in prison under the country's strict anti-abortion laws have been released. The three women have been convicted and sentenced to decades behind bars for having obstetric emergencies. El Salvador has had a total ban on abortion since 1998. Dozens have been arrested and imprisoned, accused of inducing abortions after having stillbirths, miscarriages, and other obstetric emergencies. The three women's release comes after a November ruling from the Inter-American Court of Human Rights saying El Salvador's government had violated the rights of a woman identified as Manuela, who was arrested in 2008 on charges provoking an abortion. She died in prison 2 years later. Literary icon Joan Didion has died after a battle with Parkinson's disease. She was 87 years old. The best-selling novelist, journalist, and essayist came to prominence with a collection of articles about culture and life in 1960s California. Many of Didion's works have received several honors, are considered to be modern classics. Didion is best known for books including Salvador, Play It As It Lays, The White Album, The Year of Magical Thinking, for which she won the Pulitzer Prize. In Georgia, two former election workers have filed a defamation lawsuit against Rudy Giuliani and the far-right One America News Network after they were falsely accused of manipulating votes in the 2020 election. The lawsuit states Fulton County poll workers Ruby Freeman and her daughter, who are both African-American, received death threats after a, quote, campaign of malicious lies designed to accuse them of interfering with a fair and impartial election, which is precisely what each of them swore an oath to protect. In Minnesota, a jury has found former Brooklyn Center police officer Kimberly Potter guilty of first and second degree manslaughter in the fatal shooting of Dante Wright during a minor traffic stop in April. Video from the killing showed Potter, who is white, pointing her 9mm pistol at Wright, who is black, repeatedly shouting "Taser," before firing a single bullet into Wright's chest. Potter claims she drew the pistol by mistake. Kimberly Potter will be sentenced in February. She faces up to 15 years in prison, although under Minnesota sentencing guidelines, she could receive as little as 6 years in prison. In California, Los Angeles community advocates are condemning the police killing of Valentina Orellana Peralta, a 14-year-old girl who was fatally shot by LAPD Thursday while she was inside a Burlington clothing store's changing room trying on dresses for a quinceañera. Police arrived at the store after receiving reports of an alleged assault. Officers then opened fire on an unarmed man who was also killed. Preliminary information on the shooting indicated police bullets penetrated a wall, killing the 14-year-old girl. And in Mexico, the parents of the 43 Ayotzinapa students who were disappeared in 2014 led a peaceful protest Sunday in Mexico City as they continue to demand justice for their children. The parents are urging the government of Andrés Manuel López Obrador to tell them the whereabouts of the students. This is one of the fathers.
To us, they are still alive. We cannot say they are dead until we see proof. We believe they might still be alive somewhere. That is why we are here with our hope and our faith in the Virgin of Guadalupe, who is the mother of all Mexicans.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Today, we spend the hour remembering Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The South African anti-apartheid icon died Sunday at the age of 90. In 1984, Desmond Tutu won the Nobel Peace Prize for his work fighting to end white minority rule in South Africa. That same year, 1984, he traveled to Washington, where he denounced the Reagan administration's support for South Africa's apartheid government.
Apartheid is as evil, as immoral, as unchristian, in my view, as Nazism. And in my view, the Reagan administration's support and collaboration with it is equally immoral, evil, and totally unchristian without remainder.
In 1988, Archbishop Tutu risked jail by organizing a boycott of regional elections in South Africa.
I urge black people in this diocese not to vote in the October elections, And I hope that white Anglicans will join their black fellow Anglicans in that action. I am aware of the penalties attaching to this call. I am not defying the government. I am obeying God.
After the fall of apartheid and the election of Nelson Mandela as South Africa's first black president, Archbishop Tutu chaired the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, where he pushed for restorative justice. He would later become a vocal critic of the ANC, the African National Congress, under the leadership of Presidents Thabo Mbeki and Jacob Zuma. This is Bishop Tutu speaking in 2011.
Hey, Mr. Zuma. You and your government don't represent me. You represent your own interests. And I'm warning you, I really am warning you out of love. I am warning you like I warned the nationalists. I am warning you. One day we will start praying for the defeat of the ANC government.
Archbishop Desmond Tutu also slammed the ANC in 2011 for not granting a visa to the Dalai Lama, who was invited to attend his 80th birthday. Archbishop Tutu was a leading voice for human rights and peace around the world. He opposed the Iraq War. He condemned the Israeli occupation of Palestine, comparing it to apartheid South Africa. In 2014, he backed the Palestinian-led BDS, or Boycott, Sanctions, and Divestment movement. He also spoke against torture and the death penalty. In 2011, he recorded a video calling for the release of imprisoned African-American journalist and activist Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Mumia's guilty verdict must be considered more than flawed. It is unacceptable. He has been denied the right to a new trial based on racial bias in jury selection, has faced years of prosecutorial and police misconduct and judicial bias.
Well, today we spend the rest of the hour hearing Archbishop Desmond Tutu in his own words. We begin by going back to February 15, 2003, when Tutu spoke before a massive rally in New York to oppose the imminent U.S. invasion of Iraq.
People marched and demonstrated, and the Berlin Wall fell. And communism was ended. People marched and demonstrated, and apartheid ended. And democracy and freedom were born. And now people are marching, and people are demonstrating. Because people are saying no to war. We say no to war. The just war theory says you need a legitimate authority to declare and to wage war. Only the United Nations is that legitimate authority. Any other war is immoral. The just war says, have you exhausted all possible peaceful means? And the world says, no, we haven't yet. And any war before you have exhausted all possible peaceful means is immoral. And those who want to wage war against Iraq must know it would be an immoral war. You know, those who are are going to be killed in Iraq are not collateral damage. They are human beings of flesh and blood. They are children. They are mothers. They are brothers. They are grandfathers. You know what? They are our sisters and brothers. For we belong in one family. We are members of one family, God's family, the human family. And how can we say we want to drop bombs on our sisters and brothers, on our children? We said no to communism. We said no to apartheid. We said no to injustice. We said no to oppression. And we said yes to freedom. Yes to democracy. Now, I ask you, what do we say to war?
No!
I can't hear you. What do you say to war?
No!
What do you say to death and destruction?
No!
What do you say to peace?
I can't hear you.
What do you say to peace? What do you say to life? What do you say to freedom? What do you say to compassion? Well, we want to say, President Bush, listen to the voice of the people. For many times, the voice of the people is the voice of God. Vox populi, vox Dei. Listen to the voice of the people saying, give peace a chance. Give peace a chance. And let's say once more so that they can hear in the Pentagon, they can hear in the White House, what do we say to war?
No!
What do we say to peace?
Yeah!
The late Archbishop Desmond Tutu addressing the massive anti-war rally in New York on February 15, 2003, the day millions rocked the globe for peace. When we come back, we'll hear the Nobel Peace Prize laureate talk about Guantanamo, torture, and more. Stay with us. Song for Bra Des Tutu by Winston Mankunku Ngozi. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're continuing to remember the life and legacy of former South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who died Sunday at the age of 90. I interviewed him over the years. In 2004, I spoke to him at the Culture Project after a play about Guantanamo. I began by asking Archbishop Desmond Tutu what his response was to what was happening at Guantanamo.
I thought I knew what was taking place there, and I was quite shocked when I sat through the play yesterday, just how devastated I was. I was particularly so because I had such an awful sense of deja vu. For someone coming from South Africa, you said, but I mean, that's exactly what they were doing for exactly the same reasons that they gave. I mean, you said, why do you detain people without trial? Why do you ban people as you're doing? And the response from the South African government was security of the state. And anyone who questioned it would then be regarded, especially if you're white, as being unpatriotic. And I just want to say to you, is this something that you want done in your name? Isn't it time there was the same sense of outrage that people had about apartheid, which people should have had about the Holocaust? And what would happen if it was Americans held by some other country under these conditions? The point is, God has actually got no one. The God we worship is strange. They say this God is omnipotent, but God is also very weak. There's not a great deal that God seems to be able to do without you.
During your years in South Africa, before the end of apartheid, you were a deep advocate of nonviolence, yet you saw so many detained, so many killed. What do you feel, and what did you feel then? How did you make it through those days? What did you advocate? How did you stick to your principles of nonviolence?
One of the wonderful things, actually, is when I've got to speak as a Christian, is belonging to the church and knowing that you belong to this extraordinary body. When things were really rough, it's wonderful to recall for me now that I sometimes got, when the South African government had taken away my passport, I got passports of love from Sunday school kids here in New York. And I plastered them on the walls of my office, that although I couldn't travel, hey, here were all of these wonderful people all over the world. And I had I met a nun in New York at that particular time, and I asked her, can you just tell me a little bit about your life? How do you
And she said, well, I am a solitary. I live in the woods in California. I pray for you. My day starts at 2 in the morning. And I said, hey, man, I'm being prayed for at 2 in the morning in the woods in California. What chance does the apartheid government stand? So one was being upheld. And you know, when frequently you say to people, the victory that we won against apartheid, a spectacular victory, that would not have happened without the support of the international community, without the support of people like yourselves, without the support of those who were students at the time, who might have been crazies, but they were fantastic in their commitment. And in this country, actually, they showed that you could in fact change the moral climate. Because at the time, the Reagan administration was totally opposed to sanctions. And students, but not just students, the many, many people who were prepared to be arrested on our behalf, who demonstrated on our behalf, who boycotted on our behalf, well, they changed the moral climate to such an extent that Congress passed the anti-apartheid legislation, and they even managed a veto override, which was fantastic. And so I just happened. I always say I was a leader by default because our real leaders were either in jail or in exile. And sometimes when people say, and he got the Nobel Peace Prize, I say, well, actually, you know, it was that they thought maybe it was time it was given to a black. And, he has an easy surname. Tutu, tutu. Imagine if I'd had a surname like Bukakauli, you know.
Archbishop Tutu, how do you feel? How do you feel about...
You can pronounce that.
How do you feel about the invasion and occupation of Iraq?
It was fantastic seeing the many, many people who came out in opposition. It was fantastic. You know, sometimes when you say, Americans, or, people nowadays don't care. It's not true. Millions turned out. Millions said, no, give peace a chance. And I said, as so many others, I wasn't the only one. The Pope said so too. The Archbishop of Canterbury said so. The Dalai Lama said so. That this war, if it was to be a justifiable war in terms of the just war theory, would have to be one that was declared by a legitimate authority. And the administration here was aware of that. That's why they went to the UN. There's no point in going to the UN if you had already decided. They probably, of course, had decided. But, I mean, there was no point unless they believed or they realized, I mean, that in order for it to be legitimate, and therefore justifiable, the only authority would have to be the UN. And when they didn't get what they wanted from the UN, they did what they did. We said then, and we keep saying so, not just that it was illegal, it was immoral. And the consequences of it just now, I mean, you have to be, you've really got to be blind to say, well, yeah, it's okay, we removed Saddam Hussein. Why didn't you say that was the reason for quitting? Because the world would have said, no. That isn't a reason that will be allowable for you to declare the war. And I'm sad that we seem so inured now. They tell you 100 people have been killed. And the United States and its allies are doing that. And they say, no, we targeted that house because our intelligence said so. Intelligence. The same intelligence that said there were weapons of mass destruction. Please. That's been done in your name. That mothers and children have been killed. And when you say, what about the civilian casualties? Say, sorry. Our intention was to target insurgents. And most of us, I think, just shrug our shoulders. But you see, you experienced a little bit on September the 11th the kind of thing that is meted out on a regular basis. And they're not casualties. Collateral damage. Collateral damage, I tell you. How do you feel if somebody says the people who died in the World Trade Center and in Washington, D.C., collateral damage? Say that to someone who lost a wife. Say it to someone who lost a child. Someone who lost a friend. Collateral damage. It's an obscenity. It's an obscenity.
The South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu, who died Sunday at the age of 90. I interviewed him at the Culture Project after a play about Guantanamo in 2004. 17 years later, Guantanamo remains open and U.S. troops remain in Iraq. When we come back, we'll hear Archbishop Desmond Tutu on Palestine, war, the climate crisis, and more. Stay with us. Woza Moya by South African jazz musician Herbie Tweli. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue to remember the life and legacy of South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu. He died Sunday. His funeral will be held on New Year's Day. We turn now to an interview I did with him in November 2008. We spoke at the South African Vice Consul's apartment in New York. Archbishop Desmond Tutu, it's a pleasure to have you on Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
Your response to the election of the first African-American president, a son of an African man from Kenya.
Yippee! No, yippee is actually, it captures something that is almost ineffable. It's very close to the kind of feelings we had on April the 27th, 1994. And some, maybe a few people in this country have said it was, as it were, the Mandela moment. It's a moment when especially people of color have a new spring in their step. They can walk a great deal taller than they used to. And that even though this country, the United States, experiences very considerable racism, I mean, people being dragged to their deaths behind trucks, yet it's a country that, in fact, has had this extraordinary experience, and it's something that has filled people with hope that the world can be a better place.
How did it feel for you? There were so many millions of people who voted for the first time in this election for Barack Obama. How did it feel for you? How old were you when you first voted in South Africa?
63
years old.
Yes.
When was it? What year?
1994.
For the
1994
election.
That was the first time, and the first time for Nelson Mandela, he too, this extraordinary human being, and the many others. Actually, in a way, you could say white people who had always voted in racially discriminated election were voting for the first time in a democratic, truly democratic election. So we were all, as it were, on the same page. But it was I said then when I was asked, what is your, how do you describe how you feel? I said, well, how do you describe falling in love? How do you describe red to someone who is totally blind? How do you speak about the glories of a Beethoven symphony to somebody who is deaf? Well, it's like that. I mean, I'm over the moon. I'm on cloud nine, as were most of my, if not all of my compatriots on that day.
What do you think is Barack Obama's greatest challenge as president of the most powerful country on earth following 8 years of George W. Bush?
Yes. Very clearly, it has been the fact that for those 8 years, you've had an America that followed a unilateralist line, an America that would not ratify the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. Most of the world had, and America just said, go jump in the lake. Most of the world had ratified the Rome Statute that set up the International Criminal Court, which is where the people who were responsible for September the 11th should have been appearing, that you were going to have, most people believe that he is going to be welcomed as the leader of the free world, who will be more collaborative, who will be more consultative, who will not seem to want to throw the considerable weight of America around and seem to want to be the bully boy. I've said, I did a piece for the Washington Post, and I said one of the things that would demonstrate a clean break from the previous administration would be closing the abomination Guantanamo Bay. And one would then hope that there would be a much more conciliatory approach to Iran, not to say the belligerence that has largely characterized the Bush administration. And I would hope to, and that's a major challenge, that there would be something to be done to bring a viable peace proposal for the Middle East, to end what I reckon is an unconscionable suffering of the Palestinian people, which would end the firing of Qassam rockets on Israeli citizens.
You were blocked from going into Gaza in 2006, leading a UN delegation there after the killing of a number of Palestinians. What do you think has to be done now with the Middle East, specifically with Israel and the occupation?
There's been some very interesting moves in with the outgoing prime minister suggesting that Israel has to consider very seriously the proposal of going back to the boundaries of 1967. That's a very important initiative if that was taken. I think that we would have to move very quickly to lifting the embargo. The suffering is unacceptable. It's totally unacceptable. It doesn't promote the security of Israel or any other part of that very volatile region, and it is quite contrary to the best teachings of the Jewish faith. You know, I know. I mean, that there are very, very many in Israel who are opposed to what is happening, and I pray fervently that there will be a boldness, you know, in saying we've got to resolve this. Because I think because a lot hinges on what happens in the Middle East. Let's say when that is resolved, we're going to find, I mean, that the tensions between, say, the West and the Muslim world, and a large part of the Muslim world, I believe myself, we're going to find that that evaporates, this is a sore chafing, and it's It's mucking up too many things, and I pray that this new president will have the capacity to say, we've got to do something here for the sake of our own humanity, you know, for the sake of our children.
Would you compare the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank to apartheid South Africa?
I have to speak about what I know. I mean, most people, a Jew, will usually speak about their experiences and maybe compare whatever it is that is happening with what happened in the days of the Holocaust. For me, coming from South Africa and looking at the checkpoints and the arrogance of those young soldiers, probably scared, maybe covering up their apprehension that there's no way in which I couldn't say. Of course, that is the truth. It reminds me of the kind of experiences that we underwent. I mean, I was Bishop of Johannesburg, and would be driving from town to Soweto, where we lived, and I would be driving with my wife, and we'd have a roadblock. And the fact of our having to have passes allowing us to move freely in the land of our birth. And now you have that extraordinary structure, that the wall. And I do not myself believe that it has improved security. Breaking up families, breaking up, I mean, people who used to be able to walk from their homes to a school, children, now have to take a detour that lasts several minutes. It's when you humiliate a people to the extent that they are being, and yes, one remembers the kind of experience we had when we were being humiliated. When you do that, you're not contributing to your own security, and all you are doing is you're saying to those people, in all of their desperation, we're still human, and there are things we will not be able to accept. I mean, just sit down. We have to do something. And so you get the suicide bomber, and one does not condone them, but one understands perfectly how people can be driven into a corner. And out of that desperation, and so you have that cycle, the response of Israel to the suicide bomber, which you know is going to provoke another cycle. And one says, no, that's not how God intended us to live. That it is possible. It's been shown, it happened in South Africa. It is possible for people who have been enemies to begin to think that they can be friends, at least to coexist.
The International Criminal Court, should Barack Obama as president sign on to the ICC, sign the treaty for the International Criminal Court?
Yes, if you believe in the rule of law, then you're going to say, yes, this is one particularly important instrument, because it is an instrument that is saying we will no longer tolerate impunity. The many who are guilty, as is happening just now in the DRC or in Darfur, that people who are guilty of egregious violations have to be brought to book, and it has got to be done in a way that satisfies those standards that we have. I mean, you don't hold people in detention without trial. That's what the world used to say against the South African government. And if it was true that that was wrong, it has to be wrong consistently everywhere.
President-elect Obama supports an end to the war in Iraq, but a surge of soldiers in Afghanistan. What are your words of wisdom to him?
Well, I say that obviously it's to end the war, yeah, to end the occupation. But I've also said it'd be wonderful if, on behalf of the American people, he were to apologize to the Iraqis and to the rest of the world for an invasion that was based on lies.
The late Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa. I interviewed him at the South African Vice Consul's apartment in New York in November 2008, just after the election of Barack Obama. Desmond Tutu died Sunday at the age of 90. We end today's show with the Archbishop speaking to a group of youth climate activists outside the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen in 2009.
I want to say a big thank you to all of you, especially you beautiful young ones. We oldies have made something of a mess of the world. And we want to say to the leaders who are meeting, look in the eyes of your grandchildren. Climate change is already a serious crisis today.
Yes.
But we can do something about it.
Yes.
If we don't, there's no world which we will leave to you. This generation, you won't have a world. You will be drowning, you will be burning in drought, there will be no food, there will be floods. We have only one world. We have only one world. If we mess it up, there's no other world. And for those who think that the rich are going to escape, we either swim or sink together.
Amen.
We have one world, and we want to leave a beautiful world for all of these beautiful, wonderful young generation. We, the oldies, want to leave you a beautiful world. And it is a matter of morality. It is a question of justice.
The late Archbishop Desmond Tutu of South Africa, speaking to youth climate activists outside the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen in 2009. He died Sunday at the age of 90. His funeral will be held on Sunday, on New Year's Day. So, to see all of our interviews, the speeches of Archbishop Tutu, you can go to democracynow.org. Special thanks to Brendan Allen and Mike Burke. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Teresena, Tammy Warrenoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, and Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
RCT in sound from way out.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we welcome San Francisco District Attorney Chesa Boudin, who is being challenged for his progressive policies in a recall election.
He's doing a terrific job, and that's why the Trump people all across the country have raised over $2 million to try to get rid of him. It's a bellwether. We're also joined by journalist Chris Hedges to talk about the latest and disastrous judicial decision that continues the persecution of the great journalist Julian Assange.
Julian Assange has been indicted, and the U.S. is trying to extradite him for revealing evidence of U.S. war crimes, but his prosecution is a major threat to investigative journalism.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. Chesa Boudin has been serving San Franciscans as their district attorney for nearly 2 years. He is a leading progressive in what has been called the Progressive Prosecutors Movement. Other progressive district attorneys in that small cohort are George Gascon in Los Angeles and Larry Krasner in Philadelphia. In Berger versus United States, the Supreme Court said that the duty of a prosecutor in a criminal prosecution is not that it shall win a case, but that justice shall be done. Yet all too many prosecutors are more concerned with winning cases than doing justice, which includes the protection of constitutional rights. Chesa campaigned by proposing solutions to the disaster of mass incarceration, one of the civil rights issues of our time. He introduced policies of diversion and no cash bail. He put fewer juveniles behind bars. He opposed the death penalty and focused his efforts on helping victims of crime. Chesa said that the recall effort is about criminal justice reform, that it is a question of whether we are going to go forward and continue to implement data-driven policies that center crime victims, that invest in communities impacted by crime, and that use empirical evidence to address root causes of crime in our communities, or if we are going to go back to the failed policies of Reagan and Trump. Today, Chesa's efforts are being challenged. 83,000 signatures were gathered in San Francisco by paid workers to put a recall Boudin question on the California state ballot in June. Even Donald Trump has injected himself into the campaign in what has become a national, well-funded Republican pushed. Fear-mongering is employed to create a false conception that crime in San Francisco is rising. Today, my co-host Michael Smith and I talk with Chesa Boudin about his philosophy and successful efforts as a progressive prosecutor. Chesa Boudin, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Let's talk about the causes of crime in U.S. society today. Many people say that crime has little to do with the unequal distribution of wealth, racism,